please the court. My name is Greg Sheldon. I was appointed to represent Mr. Saunders, who is present here in court today. I'll address the procedural issue first, as the Solicitor General has referred to in each of these three cases. Mr. Saunders represented himself, as I said, filed a number of different motions to dismiss, motions to set aside the verdict. There are all or many of them in both this proceeding and in prior proceedings are contained within the appendix itself. He challenged the court's, essentially the argument that we've heard earlier as far as a court would lack jurisdiction to enter a judgment if the judgment is predicated on a constitutional statute. He argued in each of these proceedings, including the instant one in front of Judge Burgess, that the statute itself was unconstitutional, that his prior conviction was thereby unconstitutional, that any proceeding based upon that would be further unconstitutional. So I disagree with the Solicitor General. I realize he was saying these things in a different case, but he addressed the jurisdictional issue in my case as well. I disagree because he certainly raised that at the revocation proceeding. He had not raised that at trial when he had been previously convicted. We certainly would concede he had to plead guilty to these charges. And then subsequent to that, when he got into the revocation proceedings, that's when these motions were filed. So we would maintain, as we did on brief, as he did at trial, at his revocation proceeding, that there is no jurisdiction. It's a subject matter jurisdiction question. It was raised before the trial court. It was properly preserved. The Court of Appeals, in its opinion in this case, determined that it was a collateral attack, and because the statute was constitutional, that collateral attack was improper. Did not reach the issue with respect to the Commonwealth's argument that there was res judicata or collateral estoppel. And I think that the closest thing you get to that is in the transcript where a frustrated prosecutor said, "Judge, we've heard all this before." And the judge says, we have. That would be the closest thing that would be to res judicata as far as it being affirmative defense being raised, being brought up to the trial court and being ruled upon before and while Mr. Saunders was present. With respect to the issues, I would adopt what Mr. Moss has said as far as the holding of McDonald v. Moose. In this case, my case is almost factually identical to Mr. McDonald's case that occurred in the Prince George Circuit Court that led to this court's decision in 2007. The only difference being, I think the ages are the same as far as the younger folks, 16 and 17, the same. The only distinction being they were young men in Mr. Saunders' case and they were young ladies in Mr. McDonald's case. And so I would adopt what Mr. Moss has said with respect to McDonald v. Moose. I think three things come down on the side of finding that the statute at the time was unconstitutional. The first is obviously the McDonald v. Moose question. Justice Mims kind of frantically looked to find my copy because I assumed you would ask me that question, and Mr. Moss sat here and watched his time run out and wasn't able to answer it, unfortunately. In looking at that, and I understand what the court is saying, I assume that Your Honor is suggesting that that phrase, that clearly established federal law, and going back and saying we're not applying the appropriate standard, or the majority is not applying the appropriate standard here. And I think certainly a point well taken by the dissent, but here in the Court of Appeals, this case was scheduled for oral argument sometime shortly after we were actually in, or I personally was in the Court of Appeals. And this, our case was stayed pending the Fourth Circuit ruling. The Fourth Circuit had ruled the petition for rehearing before the en banc Court of Appeals had been filed, and so this matter was stayed. And so the rehearing was denied. And so my argument there would be, with all due respect to Judge Diaz, I would disagree with Judge Diaz's analysis with respect to the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act based on the fact that the rehearing was denied. And then also there was a writ filed for writ of certiorari of the United States Supreme Court that was also denied. And so I think in this instance the majority here got it right. I think we can look at two other things.
Does the denial of a writ have precedential value?
It does not, Judge. And I don't argue that McDonald v. Moose has precedential value. Obviously it doesn't. And we are, Your Honors are left to determine what our law is. The federal court can interpret it under limited circumstances, but at the end of the day, you tell us what Virginia's law is, unless the United States Supreme Court somehow tells you that you're wrong. And so I think that Solicitor General and Mr. Moss touched on it as far as some amendments to the laws that have happened. The law that existed at the time that both Mr. Saunders was prosecuted and that he was ultimately had his revocation proceeding stated, if any person currently knows in any manner, any male or female, by the buyer with the mouth or voluntarily submits to such personal knowledge, class 6 felon. Since the amendment, which is in reaction, I would argue, to McDonald v. Moose, the statute now says that they currently know in any manner any brute animal, which I guess I just read the pertinent part. I left out the brute animal in the earlier version, but that was in there. The only thing left is the brute animal. So the crime of consensual sodomy is no more. And that language has now shifted, or what I would argue the language is, or should have been at the time, to the contributing to the delinquency of a minor statute. And so the part of my argument with respect to the Equal Protection Clause, and quoting the language of Martin v. Zirl, was that just with the exception of what the sexual act is, it is unconstitutional to prosecute somebody for having vaginal sex with a 17-year-old as a Class 1 misdemeanor and having oral sex with a 17-year-old as a felony. That would require a felony conviction, the potential for long incarceration, supervised probation, sex offender registry, all of those penalties. That issue we raised and Mr. Saunders raised on his own behalf, and that issue wasn't even addressed by the Court of Appeals, which is something that I pointed out to the panel that granted this issue. And so that statute has now been amended, and that was part of the Attorney General's argument when we were still before the Court of Appeals was, well, if the General Assembly thought that they should change something, they could, and they have. Well, now they have. And I think those are two important things that the Court should consider. In response to a couple of things that were said earlier, as far as the number of sex offenders that are currently incarcerated, I think the numbers were maybe 90 on the sex offender registry, 40 of which are incarcerated, and the quote was, there are too many serious offenders. I don't know if there are too many serious offenders, because they may be incarcerated now for something that's no longer a crime. And I think that's a significant consideration that the court has to take into account. Right now, if I were to go out and commit the same acts that Mr. Saunders committed, I could be prosecuted for a misdemeanor, and that's the issue. And I think in response to the Chief Justice's question, Mr. Moss responded with respect to judicial activism and with respect to interpretation. And I don't presume to speak for Mr. Moss, who has way more experience than I do, but I think what he maybe was getting at there was the argument that McDonald v. Moose Court makes with respect to reading language into a statute in order to make it constitutional. And so I understand what's been said with respect to is there any constitutional application of this statute? I would argue that there's not. And respectfully, I respectfully think that the McDonald opinion from 2007 was incorrect. I think that probably the language, this case does not involve children, it doesn't involve the public. I think that's probably the most widely cited dicta that I have ever come across in my practice. It is the go-to as far as why. It's not the holding of the case. I think they limited their holding to the statute in Texas. But I think that when you read my brief, you read everything changed, and it's McDonald v. Moose, and that's what you follow. And when you read the Attorney General, it's how many times can we use the word children over and over again? And I understand that. But in Virginia, the age of consent is 15. There's a 1925 case that says that's never been overturned. And so I will tell the court I was Mr. McDonald's trial attorney in the Prince George Circuit Court many, many years ago. And I made that argument. I was not his appellate attorney, but I made those arguments. And my argument at the time, my argument now, would be that was the age of consent. Those people were of the age of consent. It wasn't for money. It wasn't in public. It wasn't by force. It was completely consensual. And that was the argument why, as applied to Mr. McDonald, my argument here would be as applied to Mr. Saunders would be unconstitutional. And I believe that today, and I also believe that facially it would be unconstitutional. I don't believe that there is a way to get around the blanket prohibition, and that's what this statute was. And so with respect to the Attorney General's their brief, I think there is a concern about federalism and about walking across the street to the district court. And the government cited the Commonwealth v. Negri case, which is a 1965 Pennsylvania case, and the language is pretty clear, which is, and again, you're not bound by the federal court, for a federal circuit court, but the language there, I think, is pertinent, which is if we don't abide by that, then the individual to whom we deny relief need only walk across the street to gain a different result. Such an unfortunate situation would cause disrespect for the law, and the finality of judgments would become illusory. And then the Attorney General also cites Tazewell County School Board versus Brown for the statement, "We've repeatedly held that the General Assembly is presumed to have knowledge of the interpretation of statutes, and the General Assembly's failure to make corrective amendments evinces legislative acquiescence in that interpretation." They've not. And I would submit that in making that change, they've shown their intent to conform with the opinion of the McDonald case. I'm going to, if there aren't any questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Stuart Raphael, again for the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'm not going to repeat the arguments I made in the prior argument consistent with the email we received from the clerk's office. We will adopt those arguments here. I just want to address a couple points that Mr. Sheldon made. With regard to the 2014 statutory change, he's correct that the legislature took the references to oral sex and non-vaginal intercourse out of 18.2361A and put those in the other statutes that dealt with sexual intercourse. But the General Assembly did not amend 18.2-361B, which involved crimes against nature among family members. And that subsection contains an interesting age distinction. A family member who commits oral sex or anal sex with another family member commits a Class 5 felony if the victim is above the age of 18. If the victim is between the ages of 15 and 18, then it's a Class 3 felony. So the General Assembly certainly had age in mind in the scope of how the statute is to be applied. And this court in McDonald used the age of majority from Code Section 1-207. Then Justice Lemons wrote that was the appropriate limitation consistent with Lawrence to apply to the statute that's at issue today. With regard to the argument that Mr. Sheldon makes that Mr. Saunders should be treated differently because the crime involved a man with a male child as opposed to a man with a female child, he's correct that the case is indistinguishable from McDonald. That case did involve a man with a female child. This one involves a man with a male child. But you could not agree with his position without overruling McDonald. Moreover, if Saunders were right, it would be a crime for an adult to commit to have sexual intercourse with a 16-year-old girl, but not to have oral sex with a 16-year-old boy. And that is not a sensible interpretation of the statute. Courts evaluate the constitutionality of statutes with regard to the statute itself, not by comparing the statute to other statutes to see how it measures up. So, for example, if a person's convicted under the fornication statute, he can't defend himself by saying, well, if it had been oral sex, I couldn't have been charged with fornication. The statute governs conduct. It treats men and women equally. That's what this court indicated in McDonald. That's what the Court of Appeals had said in its decisions in Chian and Sing Song. The statute treats the same conduct the same, regardless of whether it's committed by a man with a woman, a man with a man, or a woman with a woman. So there is no equal protection issue here. As I mentioned in the prior argument, the procedural default issue here is quite grave because the issue was raised for the first time 3 years after the guilty plea, and it just was not preserved. So if the court holds that the statute is not facially invalid, any as-applied claim is clearly waived under the normal rules of appellate review. That's all I'll say if the court has no further questions.
Mr. Raphael, as you are very aware, the federal circuits, the federal district courts, and other Supreme Courts, state Supreme Courts around the nation, utilize a certification procedure often on a matter of Virginia law, and they'll certify a question to us, we'll hear it, interpret the law, and it's enormously deferential to concepts of federalism. However, in this case, when we did exactly that, it appears that in the Moose decision, they course, didn't defer to that because we had already spoken on the question. They simply disagreed. Now, I heard Mr. Sheldon say today that their disagreement was legitimate. I hope I'm being fair to Mr. Sheldon. Was legitimate because of the manner in which we interpreted the statute. That as a general rule, the state Supreme Court, the highest court of the state, has the authority as a final authority to interpret their own laws. But that in this case, the way we did it was somehow improper. Do you have a response to that?
Well, I think that Justice Mims was correct to point out that under the federal statute at issue in Moose, the AEDPA, Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Statute, the federal court was not supposed to overturn the state court ruling unless it was a clearly unreasonable interpretation of federal law. So the court effectively held that your decision in McDonald was an unreasonable interpretation of federal law, and we think they just clearly got that wrong.
But was it an unreasonable interpretation of state law? That's what I'm concerned about. That's why I heard Mr. Sheldon suggesting that the Fourth Circuit opinion, had it been a reasonable interpretation of state law, they would have said that's fine. But I understand him to say that his interpretation of the Fourth Circuit opinion is that we did not engage in a reasonable interpretation of our own law.
I think it has to be a reasonable interpretation of federal law. I think that's the standard under AEDPA. Mr. Sheldon can speak for himself, but the bottom line in Moose was that the court thought this court got it wrong in how it interpreted the sodomy statute in Virginia. And the two reasons that the Fourth Circuit gave were erroneous as a matter of law, the first being that it thought that Bowers was a facial attack when it was an as-applied attack, and the second being their erroneous use of the Supreme Court's decision in Ayotte. I think a fair-minded reading of the case law and the decision in Moose will lead a reasonable reader to conclude the majority just got it wrong.
All right. Well, he has 4 minutes and 20 seconds to respond. I'm sure I'll hear.
I'll try to respond. What I said was that under, I guess, AEDPA, we're calling it AEDPA, what that says is it's an unreasonable application or unreasonable interpretation of federal, of clearly established federal constitutional law. My assumption, and Justice Mims can correct me if I'm wrong, is that was kind of the concern that he had about, is it clearly established federal law and how did this court get that wrong? I think that what they're saying, and this is, again, my interpretation of what the Fourth Circuit is saying, or the two majority judges are saying, is that this court's interpretation of Lawrence v. Texas was incorrect. But I don't know that you don't reach that issue.
And what part of it was incorrect?
Well, in the Fourth Circuit?
No, in the our McDonald case, were we incorrect in reading quite literally in Lawrence that the court said in Lawrence this has nothing to do with children or public places?
Right.
If I picked up Lawrence, I could read the exact statement.
I'm sure you could flip to the page where that language is.
Yeah.
How
could you be incorrect interpreting Lawrence by reading Lawrence?
No, I'm not suggesting that. I think what they're saying is, as we read this code section, as we read 18.2.361A, and not B, because B is a whole other animal and not an issue here, but as we read that code section, is it on its face? Because I think your opinion in 2007 addressed an as-applied challenge.
You dismissed the,
I didn't raise that in the Prince George Circuit Court, I raised an as-applied challenge. Right. When I represented Mr. McDonald.
But you see, if the rule, as Justice Mims referred to earlier,
yes.
Is there any constitutional application of the statute? And if there is, it's not facially invalid. Well, we've already said in McDonald here in 2007
right.
that there is a constitutional application of the statute.
Which would be children or public places. Or
right, which right. means that a facial challenge couldn't succeed.
Because there's, I understand that the language that the Solicitor General has cited.
You just respectfully disagree.
With all due respect. And the reason I say that is because when I read your very well-written opinion from 2007, what I'm focused on is...
With which he respectfully disagrees.
Which I... What you're saying there is children, and I think there's a... And you go through the definition of children under the code section and what that means if it's a person under the age of 18. And I think there's a distinction between... My opinion of the Lawrence v. Texas, and perhaps that is where we part ways on our agreement on what the case means. My belief is that when they're talking about children, they're talking about somebody who is not of the age to consent to the sexual activity. And so a blanket, there's a difference between it, and we recognize that in the law. And so when we're dealing with any of the sex crime statutes that we have, force, threat or intimidation for somebody over 15, 13 through 15, younger than 13, if there's sexual conduct, it doesn't matter. We don't care if there's force, threat or intimidation. There's no such thing as consent. And so where I think you and I, again, very respectfully part ways, is that children and people of the age of consent.
Well, lawyers should never, ever be afraid to tell us we were wrong.
Well,
I certainly don't. that's the case, and I admire you for it. I do find it curious, and this matter is not by any means settled, that in the McDonald case in 2007, it was a unanimous opinion that included two justices of this court who are currently judges of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's hardly settled.
I agree.
All right. Well, your time has expired.
Yes, sir. Thank you all very much.
Call the next case.